This is Audible.
Children of the Deterrent by Ian W. Sainsbury. Read by Sam Phillips.
And Jamie Barbakoff.
Recorded at Pinewood Studios. For Ruth. Chapter 1. Daniel. I'm standing on a cliff edge, watching a woman fall. She falls backwards away from me, her eyes never leaving mine. There is very little wind, but as she spreads her arms, it's as if the breeze has caught her, twisting her body around like a leaf in autumn. She's naked, her dark skin silhouetting her against the turquoise waves. I think of my father and of my dear friend. I think of the future and wonder, for the first time, if it might be utterly unlike my expectations. I wonder what this feeling is. This feeling that has crept up on me and finally surfaced, fresh, unknown, and impossible to ignore. As she drops towards the rocks, I start smiling. I was born with superpowers, but you wouldn't have known it. Nothing kicked in until late puberty. I was a chubby baby, a plump toddler, a corpulent child then, finally, a fat adolescent. I never felt the urge to race an express train, leap a building, or punch through a wall. I flew once, briefly, according to Piss Creature. Piss Creature was our collective name for Pete and Chris, the nastiest, meanest kids in my class when I was 13. They were twins, big, loud, scary. Every school year has a bully or two. As sure there'll be a kid whose glasses are held together with tape, and a girl whose breasts grow faster than the rest of her body. The other kids refer to them as Crete and Piss, and some point that was amalgamated into Piss Creature, which fitted so well that it stuck until they were expelled 4 years later after setting fire to the gym. Piss Creature had nudged me out of the classroom window while I was opening it. We were only one floor up, but I was pitched through at an awkward angle. The ground rushed towards me, and for a horrible moment, I thought I would hit it face first. Somehow, I twisted my body in the air so my shoulder took the brunt of the impact. My collarbone snapped, and a fraction of a second later, white-hot pain flashed through my shoulder. As I lay on the grass moaning, I heard Piss or Crete shouting, "You see that? Pigs can fly." I spent the rest of that summer in a cast. I knew better than to rat on Piss Creature. No one ratted on anyone, ever. Funny how that rule was inviolable. But "do to others as would have them do to you" never caught on. The head teacher asked me what happened. I even had a hospital visit from the school counselor while the cast was fitted. My mother didn't ask. Someone had dragged her out of the pub in the middle of the afternoon to take care of me. And the only emotion I could detect in those dull eyes was resentment. I slipped and fell out the window. No one bought it, but they all accepted it. The teacher and the counselor because it reduced paperwork. Mum because it absolved her from taking any action on my behalf or acknowledging my existence. We were never close, Mum and I. There was another expression I'd always liked. Don't get mad, get even. All that summer, while the other kids played football, swam, or just hung around the town center, I stayed at home, hot, uncomfortable, sweating underneath the plaster, dreaming up ways of getting even. I told myself I would have my revenge. Meanwhile, the enforced lack of exercise and the ready availability of curly whirlies meant I added a few more inches to my waistline. The cast came off on the last day of the holiday. First day back, I ran straight into Piss Creature at the school gates. One of them squeezed my newly healed shoulder, eliciting an involuntary gasp of pain. The other knocked my bag into a puddle and slapped my ear hard. 4 years later, about 2 months after they were expelled, I pulled a balaclava over my head one night and visited Piss Creature's house. They had bought a car together, something sporty with blacked-out windows. It was parked round the back. Their parents were away. I checked. I gave the car a hard enough nudge to set the car alarm screaming. A light went on in an upstairs window, and a face appeared. As well as the balaclava, I'd gone for black jeans and a bomber jacket. I was carrying a baseball bat. The pair of them appeared in the garden about 30 seconds later, one carrying a crowbar, the other a rifle. Specifically an air rifle. This was suburban Britain, not the wrong side of New Orleans. The twins ordered me to put down my baseball bat. If you want to live. I managed to put it down without laughing. They realized I wasn't going to run and advanced on me slowly. I stood my ground. When they were about 10 feet away, I held up a hand.
Far enough!
They stopped automatically for a second or two. Then the one with the rifle lifted it towards me, while the other began walking again, swinging the crowbar. I placed my right hand on the roof of the car and pushed down. There was a brief, unexpectedly loud shriek of twisting metal mixed with an explosion of glass as the windscreens and side windows blew outwards. I pushed steadily until I felt the roof of the car reach the gravel of the drive. I was on one knee. The car, still making strange metallic noises, as it adjusted to its new form. It looked like an elephant had sat on it. The twin with the crowbar dropped it. His brother pulled the trigger of his rifle. Must have been some kind of automatic response, because the pellet hit the right buttock of his twin, who jerked a little, went white, but made no noise. His eyes were fixed on me. His brother's too. Terrified, the pair of them. It felt good. Really good.
Leave town, boys!
I said. This was improvised. I hadn't thought beyond wrecking their precious car. I hoped I sounded like a grizzled cowboy when I said it, despite the fact that this was Essex, not Arizona. My voice had finally broken fully, which helped. Piss Creature left the area the next day, never came back. I felt just a little pang of disappointment that they hadn't guessed my identity. Took a bit of enjoyment out of my revenge. Even without the balaclava, though, I wonder if they would have known me. During the previous 6 weeks, I had added 8 inches to my height, and all that pale, sagging fat had become dense, hard muscle. As I walked home, I realized flattening their car had only taken the edge off the high I was on. I wanted more. No. It was more powerful than that. I absolutely had to have more, and I absolutely had to have more immediately. The sudden loss of control that followed was as unexpected as it was frightening. I ran, heading out of town. Every parked car I passed, I swung a fist. I left a trail of damage the local paper didn't shut up about for weeks, blaming it on travelers, although none had been seen anywhere near the village. I woke up a few hours later in the middle of a field, starving and weak, my fists aching. I stared at my hands for a few seconds, trying to piece together what had happened. Then I stood up, washed in a stream, and was home just after dawn. Shaking and sweating, I ate a loaf and a half of bread and crawled upstairs to bed. That was nearly 20 years ago. The summer I got superpowers. Yeah, I know. Most people still don't believe in half-heroes. Those that do think we're all either dead or institutionalized. Trust me, I'm lucky I'm still able to walk and talk. I was one of the first not to self-destruct, maybe the first. There was no advice available back then. No one knew the danger we were in. No one knew what we were. My name is Daniel Harbin. I'm 36 years old. And I'm a child of the deterrent. In November, it'll be 26 years since my father vanished, died, went into hiding, returned to his home planet, discorporated, ran out of batteries, took up a life of crime, became an ascetic hermit in Tibet, went into the movie business. Pick the one you like the sound of. There's no shortage of theories out there. But I'm the only person alive who knows the truth about why Dad disappeared. And how to find him. I know. I'm not the first to go looking for the deterrent, but I'll be the last. Besides, probably being his oldest surviving child, I also have a totally unfair advantage. I have the words of Cressida Lofthouse. You've almost certainly read the book based on her notes, written under the name H.T. Beauthorpe. Hey, I can almost hear the scornful laugh from here. But hold on a second there. When I talk about her words, I'm not referring to the deterrent, the inside story of Britain's superhero, which is undeniably an interesting tale, supposedly based on information gathered by Miss Lofthouse during the years she observed my father. The Beauthorpe book is so far removed from what happened, it should be shelved in the fiction, rather than the modern history section of your local library. Luckily for me, as well as that heavily censored version of events now accepted as canon, Cress wrote a candid account, which Station would torture, maim, and kill to keep out of the wrong hands. My hands, for instance. Sorry, Station. I have bad news for you. I have Cressida Lofthouse's diary, and it's a hell of a read.
Chapter 2. Cressida, March 22, 2013. To whom it may concern. The notebooks you are holding comprise the diary I kept during the year since the discovery of Abos, the deterrent. Much of this story is now public knowledge, but there are certain facts that never emerged from the morally suspect secret government department known as Station. My goodness, I sound as bad as the conspiracy theorists. But I have one advantage over them. I knew the deterrent personally. I worked at the secret government department in question, and God help me, I kept an official record. A record I doubt will ever find its way out of the reinforced room containing Station's filing cabinets. Filing cabinets. I know. How quaint. So much disinformation has appeared on the internet over the years that I've begun to wonder if Station itself isn't planting some of the sillier theories and is actively encouraging the more extreme views. Back in 1969, I had to sign the Official Secrets Act. I understood the value of discretion when dealing with a discovery that forever changed humanity's understanding of our place in the universe. But I was also cognizant of the fact that no one country, not even my own, should keep back knowledge that might benefit our species. So I asked a few careful questions about the Act and my responsibility towards it. The gist of what I was told was that any records I kept belonged to the government, would be kept on site, and must always be read and approved by Colonel Purcell's office, as commanding officer of the station. Purcell himself told me this in a horribly patronizing manner, as if he were addressing a silly schoolgirl. Well, I decided there and then I'd keep a diary at home. Not just because I felt a moral obligation to record what really happened, but because I'm fed up with being underestimated and talked down to by pompous men. The world is changing, chaps. Father died in 1985. Hopkins and Carstairs were still running Station when that happened. As far as I know, they still are. Carstairs is a nasty piece of work. As for Hopkins, he was even worse than Purcell to work for. Still patronizing, but cold and callous with it. I didn't like his mustache either. I've recently been told I only have a short time to live. A bit late for regrets, but isn't that generally the time regrets make themselves known? At least it's not too late for me to conceal this diary. Oh, they still watch me, albeit sporadically. I suspect the house is bugged. That's one hazard of being involved with a secret government department. No one can ever afford to trust anyone, so loose ends such as myself have a habit of disappearing once we're off the payroll. I'm told my blood disorder is extremely rare, incurable and fast-acting, and Station employs so many scientists, geneticists and specialists in human biology. Perhaps you will think me paranoid. Perhaps not, if you know anything at all about my former employers. Enough. Lately, I have come to the conclusion that I did not spend my time on this planet wisely. Now that my time is up, however, I can make partial amends by telling the truth about the superhero the world knew as the Deterrent, particularly the information only I know about his actions just before he disappeared. As for my role in his life, it was mainly as an observer. These pages might suggest otherwise, but you and I would do well to remember what Abos was and what he wasn't. I know right from wrong, and even though it would have meant defying my father, I could have blown the whistle when I saw what they were doing to Abos. That I didn't do so is my most enduring regret. Abos, wherever you are, I am sorry. Cressida Lofthouse. August 31st, 1969. I don't think I've ever seen Father so excited about anything. It's hard to know where to begin. The most exciting part of all, for me at least, is that I am to be allowed to assist him and make notes. I am to delay my first year at Durham University and instead help Father with his new project. He says we'll be working weekends, nights, whatever is necessary. He couldn't tell me anything about it. Goodness only knows how I'm supposed to sleep tonight. September 1st, 1969. Father's new office is impressive. The government has certainly taken this discovery very seriously, setting up a new department within an existing organisation hidden alongside the underground at Liverpool Street Station. There are offices, a large dining hall, even dormitories down there. There are also lots of areas we were politely but firmly steered away from. The laboratory itself is modern, well-equipped and huge. I shouldn't wonder if station itself hasn't been there since before the war, though. I had no idea such places were hidden in our home city. Station. A very unimaginative name for a top-secret government department. Perhaps that's clever in a way. After all, if someone working there were to say in public that they work for station, it would just be assumed that he was referring to the railway or the bus station. Actually, getting into station, though, is far more exciting than the name suggests. I certainly felt like a spy doing it. You enter a hideously ugly concrete office building next to the train station. If you're driving, there's an underground car park and an enormous goods lift. The reception area above has secretaries, desks, telephones, security guards, and a bank of lifts. We all have name badges, and our credentials and photographs are kept on a database to be checked every time we clock on. Once through security, one enters the lift. Father and I have been issued with keys that open the emergency panel in the lift, behind which is a single button. The lift then goes down to station. The rooms above are apparently completely unused. It's all very exciting. Father has a nameplate on his door. I must admit that Professor Graham Lofthouse, Chief Scientist, sounds far more grandiose than Head of Chemistry. After I fixed him a J&B this evening, he told me to pour one for myself. I could hardly believe it. He proposed a toast to our bright new future. Then another to the future of humanity. He even hugged me. The first time since Mother's funeral. I waited until I was back in my room before I cried. I know he can't bear to see me cry. He's happy. That's the most important thing. September 3rd, 1969. Today, Father showed me what all the fuss is about. It was difficult not to admit to a feeling of anticlimax. Perhaps if I were a scientist like him, I would be more excited. He ushered me into a small room where I had to wash my hands, put my hair in a net, very glamorous, and don a pair of surgical gloves. Then we went through to a much bigger room where Father introduced me to the scientific team. Peter McKean is a geneticist like Father. They've worked together before. I remember him coming round for dinner when Mother was still alive. He's short, serious, taciturn. He always struck me as a man who would only read books that he considered improving and would avoid fiction entirely. Now, I may be doing him a disservice, but he does seem awfully lacking in imagination. Roger Sullivan is an American, so naturally I expected him to be brash, loud and insincere. Well, shame on me for my uptight English preconceptions. Roger is a softly spoken, polite man who has the knack of making you feel as if you're the only person in the room when he talks to you. Oh, all right, he's handsome too. Oh, I'm gushing, how ridiculous. He's there because of his knowledge of metallurgy, although he seems to be an expert on comets, asteroids and meteorites, judging from the briefing today. Sandra Hodge is a government scientist. She wasn't particularly forthcoming about her speciality, and she has a forbidding glare that discourages asking questions. She's as old as Father, if not older. Mid to late 50s would be my guess. She dresses as if her gender must be disguised, or subdued at all costs. Underneath that lab coat there's an awful lot of tweed. Her chest is large and apparently solid. She's terrifying, frankly. I found myself wondering if she'd ever had sex. Does she know it's 1969, not 1939? Still, I'm hardly one to talk. It's not as if I embraced the sexual revolution. I'm not sure that a few half-hearted fumbles in nightclubs count, do they? Oh, dear God, I sound as if I'm sexually frustrated. Well, perhaps I am. Not much chance of changing that around here. Unless Roger... Oh, stop it, Chris. Mike Ainsley is my age. Lanky. Hair down to his shoulders. I notice Captain Hopkins giving him a disapproving look. A droopy moustache and round wire-rimmed glasses. I think he would like to believe he looks a little like John Lennon, but he's too gawky and unsure of himself to pull it off. He's clumsy, too. Dropped his tea down his front when I asked him the time, and he checked his watch with a full cup in his hand. Father says his thesis was outstanding, and he'll undoubtedly be one of the preeminent scientists of his generation. If he ever stops wearing his cardigan inside out, that is. He may be outstanding, but he seems to be here to perform the dog's body duties that no one else wants to do. Once the introductions were over, leaving Mike mopping his soaked shirt with a napkin, Father showed me the cylinder. It was in the middle of the room on a large metal table. While I stared at the thing and tried not to look underwhelmed, Father told me the story behind its discovery. It was found in the foundations of one of the new buildings going up in Marsham Street in Westminster. I've seen the buildings Father was referring to. Great concrete monstrosities. I know we have to move with the times, but honestly, is there any excuse for such ugliness? It's only a few streets away from the Tate Gallery, which has long been a favourite haunt of mine. Imagine coming out after gazing at those beautiful pictures and being confronted with that horror on the skyline. I digress. The construction workers turned up to work one morning and, about an hour into their digging, uncovered something strange. It was an odd-looking thing, and it only took one of them to say the words unexploded bomb for the site to be cleared and the foreman to telephone the police. The police called the army. The army came in, took a look, and sent a query up the ranks to their most senior scientific officers. That was how Colonel Purcell got involved. After taking a look himself, he ordered the item to be brought here. Station is Purcell's department, and I think he's been here a good while. Can't say how long, because if he doesn't like the sound of a question, he doesn't answer it. When I asked him directly, he gave me the silent treatment. The same as when I asked what else went on at station. He knows I'm here to document our findings, but he does nothing to conceal his distaste at the idea. It was obviously foisted upon him from above, and he resents it. The man is profoundly unhelpful. Apparently, the construction company was told that it was indeed an unexploded World War II bomb, an experimental weapon which explained its unusual appearance. I doubt the workmen who found it were convinced by this story, but Purcell seems certain that no mention of this will ever appear in the press. How he can be so confident, I have no idea. I imagine a government department that has remained hidden in an underground building near the centre of London without a single mention in the newspapers knows one or two things about secrecy. Once the item arrived, Purcell assembled the scientific team. From the little that Father has let slip, they were recruited by appealing to their scientific curiosity and their patriotism. That, and a salary they would never get close to in academia. Despite Father's enthusiasm, this seems a little too much like bribery or hush money to me. I wonder what they would say if he wanted to leave the project, or if I changed my mind. There's a kind of institutional ruthlessness about Purcell and his team that I don't much care for. In the interests of trying to be thorough, I will list them here, but as they have made it clear they will not be fraternizing with the civilians, I only have my first impressions to go on, and they weren't good. To a greater or lesser degree, they all make me feel uncomfortable. There's Colonel Purcell, Lieutenant Colonel Faraday, Captain Hopkins, worst of the bunch, and Captain Mansfield. Various uniformed underlings scurry about obeying their orders, but they appear to be nameless and interchangeable. The item itself is, as I said, a little disappointing. It's cylindrical, 6 feet, 4 inches long, 58 inches wide, 4 feet deep, tapering at both ends. It's transparent and hollow, approximately 6 inches thick. I had once seen a German bomb in a museum on a school trip. It was 10 feet long and weighed more than a ton. It scared me half to death. In contrast, the cylinder I saw today, supposedly heralding a new scientific age for Great Britain and the world, looks more like a school science experiment. Inside the container, occupying about a third of the space available, is a blue-green substance. It's a thick liquid. I heard Miss Hodge refer to it as semi-solid. To me, it looks like nothing more than mushy peas. If you can imagine mushy peas with a blue tinge on the surface. Doesn't sound very appetizing, does it? Two facts about the item have caused an immense amount of excitement and led to this vast secret place being reorganized to study it. Firstly, the transparent material is not, as one might suppose, made of glass. Some kind of metal. Don't ask me how. That's Roger's field of expertise, and he's convinced we are in the presence of the single most important scientific discovery of the century. He looks even more handsome when he's passionate about something. I just had a little giggle to myself at the thought of mixing up my official record with this diary. I can't begin to imagine Colonel Purcell's face if he were reading this. The second fact that has everyone freaked out is the goo inside. The mushy peas. Whatever it is, it displays what Mr. McKean called an undeniable homeostatic condition observable under changeable conditions, combined with, theoretically, some kind of circulatory system. I must have looked blank because Roger leaned over and whispered, "He thinks it's alive." No one said it aloud, but I imagine everyone must be wondering the same thing as I am. Can this really be a coincidence? Some kind of unknown device, constructed of material beyond our capabilities, containing, possibly, something that is in some sense alive, appearing in the middle of our capital city in August 1969. 1 month after humans first walked on the moon.
Chapter 3. My early childhood was unremarkable. Abnormal things started happening to me in 1998. George said I should write it down. All of it. Relive it once, only once, by writing it the way I lived it. Then read it back with the perspective I have now. Now that I know what really happened. Now that I know the lengths station will go to, the lengths they were always prepared to go to. George was right about everything else. She's probably right about this. January has turned out to be unreasonably warm this year. Or perhaps it's just this part of the country. It's certainly warm enough for me to sit outside with the laptop, occasionally looking up across the fields to the sea. Right, the story of my life so far, at least the bits that need telling. Who, where, when, and what, is what journalists say? In which case, me, a small Essex town, 1998, and my balls. It all started with my balls. The summer before my 18th birthday, my balls finally dropped. They did so in a dramatic fashion. I was woken by a loud noise one Saturday morning. The dream I had been ripped away from me was generic in nature. Familiar to anyone who is, or once was, a teenage boy. It involved teenage girls. I think I'll leave it at that. I had been asleep in my customary position, on my back, one hand down my pajama bottoms. I knew immediately something was different, and a quick fumble around my genitals confirmed it. When I realized what it was, I wept with joy. Literally, I lay in bed, one hand checking my chin for anything that might be described as stubble, the other cupping my undeniably saggier testicles, heaving out enormous sobs as tears of relief ran down my face. I doubt there's ever been another adolescent male more prepared for the onset of puberty. I had spent hours in the local library, squirreled away in the corner, reading every book on male development. I studied the diagrams, made notes about the changes that might occur. I knew the signs and had been checking myself daily since I was 13. It's hard to explain how terrible it was to be a late developer in an Essex comprehensive school in 1998. After PE, there were communal showers. Communal showers. What oafish, unfeeling, ignorant twat thought that was a good idea? Communal showers at the stage when the majority of teenagers, other than the lucky few who were somehow moved directly from childhood to adulthood, were desperate for privacy. Communal showers. Unbelievable. As well as having a hairless chest, armpits, and groin to hide. I also had a pair of breasts some of the girls would have envied, perched above rolls of fat. Half of my classmates called me Danielle, asked my bra size, and generally derived a great deal of enjoyment from my physical appearance. I learned to say nothing. My voice was high, flutting, hard to deliver a withering riposte asserting my masculinity when I sounded like Barbara Bloody Windsor. If I'd been intellectually gifted, artistically talented, or even a class clown, I might have found some respite from the taunts of my peers. But I was average in every sense other than my size. Try fading to the background when your arse hangs over the sides of your chair and your thighs can barely squeeze under the desk. School was a living nightmare, a torturous, endless endurance test. English was the only lesson I enjoyed. I had a little aptitude and some feeling for the subject. When we studied Shakespeare and I first heard Shylock's speech in The Merchant of Venice, I felt, for the first time, that sense of awe when someone reaches out from the pages of a book and, across centuries, speaks directly to you. I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer, as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? I was no Jew, just a painfully shy obese kid. But when Mrs. Hargreaves read that speech aloud to a class of bored 15-year-olds, I was transfixed. And when she read the next line, I was aware of Pete and Chris in my peripheral vision. And if you wrong us, do we not revenge? If I had known then what I would become, I might have derived some comfort from it. Then again, maybe not. That summer morning, balls in hand, tears wet on my cheeks, I became aware of my anomaly. I reached out for the glass of water I kept on my bedside table, only to find it wasn't where I expected it to be. The table itself wasn't where I expected it to be. I dried my eyes on the pillowcase. Something was wrong. It was a question of perspective. I squinted at the ceiling. The dusty Airfix Spitfire dangling from the light looked further away. The water was unreachable because the table was now a couple of feet higher than it should have been. Either that or... It was at that moment that my mother opened the door. Unusually, she didn't knock. It wasn't that she had a greater regard for my privacy than the architects who designed school showers. It was more that she feared seeing my corpulent form before I'd covered it.
"What the hell was that?"
she said, as she walked into my room. An unlit cigarette dangled from her lips. She looked older than her 38 years. I imagine an impartial observer might have put her in her mid-50s. Sustained alcohol abuse will do that to a person. She was wearing makeup, but it was the remnants of the previous night's slap. The black trails of mascara making her look like a melodramatic actor on a daytime soap.
What was that?
For one crazy moment, I thought she was referring to my testicles. She looked at me in disgust, since that was my mother's default expression when in my company. I paid it no mind, but I did take my hand out of my pajamas. She was waving a finger, indicating the bed. Her mouth was working, the cigarette clinging to her lower lip as she made sounds, but her brain had not yet provided her with enough horsepower to put together a comprehensible sentence. I was used to this. Children of drunks generally are. I waited for the sounds to resemble words. Eventually, she managed one of the clearest sentences I've ever heard from her before midday on a weekend. Or a weekday, to be fair.
"You can pay for this out of your pocket money, you lazy fat bastard."
I didn't respond. Even to point out that she had never given me any pocket money. Most of the money I'd saved came from my Sunday job stacking shelves at the supermarket. I supplemented this meager income by stealing from her. The money went out on school clothes and books she'd forgotten to buy, or groceries. Sometimes her need for booze was so strong, she forgot to shop for anything else. She backed out of the room and shut the door, quietly. She never slammed doors in the daytime. Too hard on the hangover. It was only when she'd drunk away the previous night's damage that she would happily slap doors and kick things. Me, mostly. I sat up fully. That's when I realized what had happened. Rolling off the bed, I looked back at the damage. The crash that had woken both me and my mother had been caused by the bed collapsing, depositing me on the floor. All four solid wooden legs had snapped like matchwood. There were splinters on the carpet. It looked as if someone had taken a sledgehammer to them. It wasn't a particularly sturdy bed, but even so. Briefly, mourning the world-class collection of videotape pornography that had been crushed, I felt the excitement that had arrived along with my freshly dangling testicles begin to diminish. I might be on the cusp of adulthood, but I was still obese. What kind of kid lets himself get so fat that his bed can't bear his weight? I stood up slowly, looked at myself in the mirror, and got my third shock of the morning. I moved closer to make sure I wasn't imagining things. My face looked back, and my eyes were drawn to the faint beginnings of stubble. Yes! I doubt anyone would have spotted any other changes. My mother had noticed nothing, but that didn't count for much. I could have shaved my head and painted it bright orange without her commenting. But I could see the difference. I looked at my flabby face and, hesitantly, an unfamiliar smile crept across my features. There was no doubt about it. I had lost one of my chins.
Chapter 4. March 14th, 1971. A visit from the top brass today. I suspected something out of the ordinary was on the way because of the amount of cleaning and tidying that's gone on in the place in the last few days. No one said anything, though. I was writing up my notes when they arrived. Not that there's much to write up these days. But I try to make some kind of effort to earn the very generous paycheck they give me every month. There are only so many ways one can state the same thing. Day 54, no change. Day 81, condition of item unaltered. Day 267, tests on the item yield no new knowledge about its nature. Miss Hodge has seen her hours reduced to 7 or 8 per week. McKean and Roger still come in, but their shifts are shorter. Even Father has reduced his working hours, arriving later in the morning and leaving mid-afternoon most days. I seem to replace his bottle of J&B far more often than I used to. It's hard not to worry about him. I don't know what he expected from this project, but I'm sure it wasn't boredom. Only Mike keeps up his regular full-time schedule. Purcell himself greeted our visitors and showed them into the lab. Father shook some hands and mouthed some social niceties. I watched through the glass from the office next door, all the while ostentatiously writing notes. We'd all been told to look busy, and I didn't intend to let the side down. As he waved his arms around in full professorial fashion, no doubt dropping in impressive technical jargon, the lab is all but soundproof, so I couldn't make out what he was saying. The small party of besuited men ignored him and went straight to Abos. Oh, I've just flicked back through the pages and realized I've yet to explain our subject's nickname. For months, it was the item, until I overheard Mike talking to it while he mopped the lab. He didn't hear me come in and was chatting away as if to a friend. And then Phil Spector was brought in to produce it, and so to me it sounds like a mess. I mean, it just isn't the Beatles anymore. Did you know what I mean, Abos? I was right behind him by that point. Abos? He dropped the mop and jumped about 3 feet into the air. Miss Lofthouse, I was just keeping the item abreast with current popular music trends. Yes, so I see. I couldn't resist teasing Mike. Although we were the same age, there's something young and puppy-like about him, and I know I act much older than 20. I've run the household since I was 14. I often feel socially awkward or inadequate, but I can relax around Mike because he's even more inept than I am. Why Abos? Mike blushed and pushed his glasses up his nose. It's just, well, oh, it's silly, it's a nickname, really, and, you know, it's just something. I waited. Eventually he came to the point.
One night, I called it an amorphous blob of slime and the name stuck in my head. It's like I said, silly. Abos. Amorphous blob of slime. I considered it for a few moments and realized I liked it. If McKean was right, and the sludge inside the cylinder was alive, it was only right to give it a name. I like it, I said. Abos it is. As impossible as it sounds, I believe Mike managed to blush a little more. Anyway, the visitors clustered around Abos and didn't seem to pay Father very much attention at all. As they were peering at the cylinder, Miss Hodge bustled in with some paperwork and wrote some figures on the blackboard in the corner. Before she had been there 2 minutes, the door swung open again, and McKean and Roger came in carrying instruments I hadn't seen for months. Once Father had introduced them to the suits, they started taking measurements, recording temperatures, comparing readings, and so on. At that point, I understood what was going on. Father was putting on a show. Nothing has changed since we first saw Abos a year and a half ago. We've learned virtually nothing apart from the fact that it is impossible to gain access to the contents of the cylinder. Nothing will cut, dent, or even slightly mark the transparent surface. Every known chemical combination has been tested, along with extremes of temperature. Because of McKean's insistence that Abos is alive, a television and radio were wheeled in, and educational programs played. English language lessons, basic biology, that kind of thing. No response from Abos, but a gradual deflation of excitement from all of us. When I caught a glimpse of the bearded man at the center of the small group, I understood what the visit was about and why Father was so desperate to impress them. Even I, with my feeble grasp of politics, was able to recognize the Chancellor of the Exchequer. They stayed for 5 minutes, then went straight to Purcell's office. I saw Father's shoulders slump as the door closed behind them. Oh, dear. March 15th, 1971. They're not quite closing us down, but it feels like it. Father called a meeting this afternoon after spending much of the morning with Purcell. He came straight to the point. Our funding is being cut by 90%. The silence was grim after that bombshell. McKean broke it.
Oh, bloody politicians. There's an election coming and they want to protect their skins. Find some extra cash to bribe the electorate with. Scum.
Roger was upset too. His eyes actually blaze when he's angry. I may have flushed a little.
Idiots! How can they turn off the tap now?
I know we haven't been able to get into the cylinder, but it's not as if we can drop a bomb on the bloody thing, is it?
There are new technologies being developed which could change everything. I was in Cambridge last week, watching gas-assisted laser-cutting tools go through steel. In the States, my old team are working on...
Father cut him off with a weary wave of his hand.
There's no point, Roger. It's over.
The decision has been made.
We will meet here once a quarter. If there is any change in the item's status, we will be recalled, but for now, we all need to find alternative employment. We can expect glowing letters of recommendation, at least.
No one responded. A good job in a university science department could hardly replace the possibilities lying there in the lab. But everyone present understood we'd run out of options. No progress had been made.
So what happens to Abos, the item?
Mike rarely spoke up in meetings, and when everyone swung round to look at him, he stared at the floor.
It stays right here, said Father. The new budget means I will be here one day a week. Mike, if you can find a part-time job that will allow you the time, I'd like you to come in every morning and keep up regular observation.
Mike nodded. Funny. I almost fancy he thinks of Abos as his friend. The rest of the meeting involved a few half-hearted complaints, some fruitless speculation about the next election, and a great deal of bitterness. Father told me later that I can continue to keep records, accompanying him once a week. I have been offered a secretarial position in a nearby government department for the other 4 working days, if I want to take it. Instead, he encouraged me to go to university as a mature student. He knows that's what I've always wanted. I took a long look at Father's tired eyes. I'm convinced that if I were to leave home and pursue my studies, he would be utterly lost without me. So I lied and said I wanted nothing more than to stay in my favourite city with my wonderful father and continue to help him with Abos, despite the funding cuts. He didn't even try to hide his relief. So, no university degree then,
and a menial dead-end career for life. Not a good day for anyone. It ended even more badly. Roger made a pass at me. I know, it's what I wanted. We've been flirting for months, but I wasn't sure it would be a good idea to mix work and pleasure. Besides, he'd never yet even asked me for a drink after work. Recently, I've started to think I must have been misreading the signs. We all went to the Mason's Arms this evening. Even Sandra Hodge, although she only stayed long enough to sit primly at a bitter lemon before saying a curt goodbye and leaving. Roger had squeezed in next to me on the bench, and I was extremely aware of his leg pushing against mine as we sat there. Roger and Father were talking about microprocessors, an innovation I had never heard of and was struggling to understand. Why on earth would anyone want a computer in their home? They'd have to set aside a whole room for it. Roger seemed enthusiastic anyway. I was unable to contribute much, partly because of my ignorance of the subject, but also because of that leg. McKean was drinking pints of stout, one after the other, saying little. While Father was at the bar, Roger slipped an arm around me for a moment and whispered something. I have no idea what he said because all I was aware of was the fact that he had gently licked my earlobe. After nearly spilling my drink, I managed to compose myself, although I was convinced my face must be broadcasting my feelings. Which were what, exactly? Shocked? A little. Annoyed? No. Turned on? Yes, very. No point denying it. So when Roger was at the bar, and Mike said something to me when he stood up to leave, I had to make him repeat it. I said, did you know Roger's living with a girl? Mike held a cloth cap between his fingers and was kneading it nervously. He looked miserable. I felt a stab of anger. Just behind it there was a flood of understanding because I knew it was true. It explained why Roger had never asked me out. The fact that he had never mentioned this girl also spoke volumes. At that moment, however, I was too upset to think straight, and I'm ashamed to say it, I took it out on poor Mike. I told him to mind his own business, reminding him it was the 1970s, not the 1930s, and who I chose to sleep with was my concern. No, I don't understand why I said those things. The only male I've slept with is Mr. Tedkins, the bear I've had since I was tiny. My decision to stay in London felt like I'd just turned my back on 3 years away from home. A chance to embrace my womanhood, lose my virginity, fool around, as Roger charmingly puts it. And now Mike had spoiled this little glimpse of sexual freedom by telling me what deep down I already knew. Roger is a cad. It's an old-fashioned word, but when it comes right down to it, I'm an old-fashioned girl. It happened when I was coming back from the toilet. The Mason's Arms is one of those pre-war pubs where the toilet is still outside. I just stepped out when a shape emerged from the darkness. I think I shrieked a little and then giggled at my nervousness. It was Roger, of course. I'm not going to go into every detail here, as I intend to forget what happened as quickly as possible. Suffice to say, he had made a unilateral decision that we were going to have sex right then and there against the wall of the pub, as if I was a cheap whore. He had his hand up my skirt and was kissing me before I knew what was happening. Apparently being pushed away and told no over and over is meaningless to him. He treated it like foreplay. A swift knee to the genitals did the trick, though. I walked back to the pub, leaving him vomiting in the gutter. Father was just standing up when I got back in. Shall we call it a night, Chris? I nodded mutely at him. He was so wrapped up in what had happened that he didn't really look at me. Wonder if he would have noticed anything if he had. When we got outside, Roger was just coming back in. He held the door open for us.
You look peaky, Sullivan, said Father. I suggest you call it a night.
I think you're right, sir. Roger smiled at him and winked at me.
What the nerve of the man.
Good night, sir.
Good night, Cressida.
Good night.
The word was out before I could stop it, and as we walked to the tube station, I knew I would never mention what Roger had done. After everything that's happened, I wouldn't want to do that to Father. I know Roger's a key member of the team. At least I'll only have to see him once a quarter.
Chapter 5. The summer of 98 was one of the best of my life, right up to the day when it all turned to shit. At first, I assumed the changes in my body were part of puberty. All the books mentioned a time frame during which puberty would begin, and I knew I was at the far end of late. What the books didn't do was detail any unusual changes late developers might experience. For all I knew, what was happening might be commonplace in those who nearly made it to their 18th birthday before their voices dropped. I assumed I had been suffering constitutional delayed puberty. It was inherited from one or both parents. I was still weeks away from the revelation about my father's identity, and there was no way I was going to ask Mum when she'd first grown pubic hair. So when, just over a week after I broke the bed, my head brushed the lintel of my doorframe, I put it down to the growth spurt, which might be commonplace during constitutional delayed puberty. I had developed the kind of obsessive relationship with my mirror associated with narcissists. I spent far too long looking at myself, my gaze wandering from my face to my chest, stomach, groins, legs. And thanks to a cunningly positioned second mirror propped against the cupboard, my arse. I had a better excuse than most for my fixation. My appearance was changing daily. A fortnight after the incident with the bed, I was down to just two chins. I'm not sure how many 17-year-old boys have whooped and fist-pumped the air on discovering a double chin, but I danced around the room when I saw mine. From five chins to two in 15 days. By the following weekend, I was down to one. The changes in my body were even more remarkable. But since I could conceal them by continuing to wear baggy clothes and making sure I slouched, I didn't attract any unwanted attention. I had just left school forever. It was holiday time. And since I didn't have a single friend, no one witnessed my impossible transformation. Mum was around every day, but it was easy to stay out of her way. I left the house every morning and didn't return until late afternoon, by which time she was drunk enough not to notice me. Even if she did, she was unlikely to remember it the following day. I had been accepted at a North London college to take a degree in English. The college in question called itself a university, but we all knew you only went there if you couldn't get in anywhere else. I didn't care. I was finally getting away. I had applied for a student loan. I'd be able to rent a room in a shared house. I could escape. And, since no one at university was likely to know me, my changed appearance would go unnoticed. Although as I admired the slabs of muscle where my sagging breasts used to hang, I dared to hope I might attract a little female attention. It's difficult to look back without pitying the optimistic young man I briefly became that summer. I might have gone to university. I might have got a degree, a job, a normal life, a girlfriend, kids maybe, one day. But even then, even as I posed in front of the mirror, I think there was a part of me, the part that had got used to the 100 insults every day, that knew there would be a price to pay. I just didn't know how high that price would be. I took the bus to Harlow every day. I told Mum I had a summer job, but that was just to stop her asking questions. Not that it was likely she would. That would mean taking an interest in my life. Tilkley Business Park stood in an undeveloped wasteland 3 miles out of town. Built in a flurry of early 80s economic optimism, its developers had hoped to entice companies from London's booming financial services industry. The timing couldn't have been worse. Before the park was even half completed, the economic crash sucked away all the interest along with all the cash. There had been a few unsuccessful attempts to reverse the site's fortunes over the years. Now, the few completed buildings gave the otherwise empty landscape an eerie atmosphere, like a 1970s science fiction film with a tiny budget. A cheap, man-in-a-rubber-suit monster wobbling around the cracked concrete roads wouldn't have looked out of place. For a few weeks, I had the place to myself. My first visit was the most memorable. I got off the bus at the stop after Tilkley, jogging the mile back. Jogging was a new experience, and I relished it, feeling no pain in my legs, no slap of fat against fat, no burning lungs as I casually ran along the road to the entrance. I didn't realize how fast I was going until I caught up with a cyclist. Not wanting to draw attention, I backed off. I couldn't stop smiling. When I reached the park, I didn't slow. Just turned into the curving entrance road leading to its chain gates, then followed the metal fencing to the left, where a forest butted up against the southern perimeter. I ran a whole circuit of the site. The back entrance was locked. At one point, the trees grew as close as 3 yards to the fence. And it was here that I left the path and headed into the cool shade of the forest. From there, I climbed a tree and had a good look at the site. Despite the prominent signs on the gates and fence, I doubted Tilkley Business Park was patrolled 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The whole place was surrounded by an unbroken 12-foot steel chain-linked fence topped with razor wire. Why pay for a security company, too? There were signs with pictures of video cameras on them, but no actual cameras. The place was too far out of town for local teens or druggies to hang out. There was graffiti, but it was old. The place was deserted. It was perfect. I just had to work out how to get in. I inspected the fence. Right at the top, just under the razor wire, it looked like it might be possible to peel back the metal links, which were rusting. Over the course of the previous week, I'd started getting stronger every day. There were 3 bent forks, a crushed tin of cat food, and a telephone book ripped in two to prove it. If my half-baked plan of becoming a freelance writer had failed, I could always enter the world's strongest man competition. I squinted at the top of the fence. I was sure I'd be able to bend the metal, if I could get up there. I decided to take a run up, jump as high as I could, grab the fence and climb the rest of the way. Every kid has climbed a chain-linked fence. It's easy when you're 8 years old and weigh very little. It's a different story when you weigh, well, I have no idea what I weighed. I stood on a big pair of scales at Boots the week before, and they're broken. I had no desire to find out what effect the kind of weight might have on my fingers if they were the only thing supporting me as I hung from the fence. I took 10 paces backwards, eyeing the area I hoped to reach when I jumped. I decided that if it was too painful to climb the fence, I'd just have to find another way in. That proved to be unnecessary. About 6 steps into an explosive run-up, I pushed down into the dirt as hard as I could with my right leg and propelled my body upwards. My fingers formed claws ready to grab the chain links. I missed the fence. It passed under me. I was at least 5 feet above the razor wire as I soared over it, my mouth open in surprise and delight. I had about a second to panic about landing before my feet hit the concrete. There was no grace in the maneuver that followed. I rolled 6 or 7 times in total before coming to rest in an untidy heap, face down in a nettle. Weirdly, my face didn't hurt at all. I sat up and crossed my legs underneath me, taking stock. My fat had turned to muscle. I was now over 6 feet tall. I could jump about 15 feet into the air, and my face could withstand the sting of a nettle. Does resistance to nettle stings count as a superpower? I'd like to think it does. I don't know if anyone will understand this or believe it, but I didn't spend much time wondering what was happening to me. I didn't care. I was alive, strong, fast, unstoppable. I sat there and laughed at the sheer joy of being alive. It was a great moment. I came up with the daily routine. I'd arrive at Tilkley and jog around the site, the first couple of laps to make sure I was alone before upping my speed. I discovered I could run fast. How fast, I couldn't tell. But I guessed my pace was somewhere between keen amateur runner and professional athlete. I wouldn't be outrunning a car anytime soon. But I was respectably quick. I could sprint very fast, but only over short distances. About 100 yards before my lungs started to burn, and my legs couldn't take any more punishment. That lick of speed was surprising considering my size. My incredible growth spurt had settled down a little, It looked like my height would top out at about 6'3"